From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Lots going on for you tonight. Later on in the program, open lines, of course. It's Friday night. At the end of the show, a special tribute to the late Dr. Evelyn Paglini, who passed away of heart issues several days ago. That was a very sad story as well. And a couple guests for you for the first couple hours tonight here on Coast to Coast AM. But here's what's happening. Tyson Foods is recalling 75,000 pounds of chicken McNuggets after some customers have complained about finding small pieces of plastic in their food. The recall includes Tyson 5-pound bags of frozen white meat chicken nuggets that were sold at Sam's Club stores across the country. So take heed on that. Well, they are inaudible to humans, but they would be music to the ears of searchers hoping to find clues to the fate of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. They're the sounds believed to be emanating from the underwater locator beacons known as pingers that were attached to the jet's cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder. But the clock is ticking. Their batteries are not guaranteed to work for more than 30 days. They are now at day 28. And they may not even make it that long. The recorders had been scheduled for battery replacements in 2012, but they were never returned for the overhaul. So people are still baffled, still no clues about that disaster. A German skydiver who was participating in a 222-person jump in Arizona was killed when her main chute just malfunctioned. She's 46 years old of Berlin, Diana Paris. She's taking part in a world record attempt for the most skydivers, changing from one formation to another in one jump. Her main chute was released too low to the ground for the reserve chute to work. Well, the death toll from the Ebola outbreak in coastal West Africa now has risen to 84, dozens more ill. The deaths among 131 cases so far reported by the World Health Organization, which said the outbreak has rapidly evolved since originating in the forests of southeastern Guinea. Well, do animals have a sixth sense for detecting natural disasters before they hit? Though scientists have been hard-pressed to prove it, a recent online video of bison stampeding down a highway in Yellowstone National Park has set off rumors across the Internet. A 4.8 magnitude earthquake struck the park on Sunday, as we reported. That's the strongest tremor the park has felt since 1980. As you know, there is a caldera at Yellowstone, and if it erupts, it could be a disaster for the entire planet. Cal Ori wrote the book, The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes. It's about Jim Berkeley, and over the past 15 years, Cal has written more books and articles on just about any topic that you can find. And her quake warnings about Jim Berkeley, of course, have saved a lot of people. Her favorite hobby is predicting California, Nevada earthquakes. Let's bring Cal in on this story about Yellowstone. Cal, I want your take on the bison heading for the hills there.
Well, I've watched the YouTubes, the trailers everybody's putting up there. It's pretty frightening. And I called somebody today in Yellowstone, an innkeeper, and she acted like it was normal and that I was a little bit out there crazy. And her husband or whatever in the background was kind of giggling. So they're pretty complacent there. But it kind of reminds me of back in 1980, Mammoth Lakes. We were getting several quakes, 6.0s, four of them in May, and hundreds of smaller ones. And the USGS, they actually put out warnings. And what happened was it fizzled. Nothing ever came out of it. So the government's really cautious. They don't want to do that because if it doesn't pan out, then tourism plummets. It causes chaos, panic. Right. And sometimes that could be even worse if nothing happens.
Well, and let's hope nothing does happen, Cal. But as we've talked and as I've talked with Jim Berkeley over the years, this caldera at Yellowstone erupts every 600-some-thousand years. It's overdue. And if it blows its top, it could be a worldwide disaster, couldn't it?
I know. I was looking at that map you have on your site, and I was seeing how close it is to South Lake Tahoe. All the ash fallout would not be good. We'd go into what, like a nuclear winter. It's very frightening if it did happen, and nobody knows. And if the government does, again, they're not going to tell us. You know that. They're going to cover it up. Once again, panic and chaos is crazy. Looting, people just go nuts. I mean, if they told us right now that we were going to have a super volcano, it's going to blow. What do you think the average person's going to do?
Yeah, that's
They're going to
exactly
go
right.
nuts.
You got it. Cal, thank you so much. Keep following up on this story. After a winter slowdown, the job market hit a milestone in March as the private sector finally recovered. They said all of the jobs lost in the 2008 financial crisis. I don't quite believe that, but that's what they're reporting. The U.S. economy added 192,000 jobs, and the unemployment rate now has remained at 6.7% in March. A California appeals court has reviewed a malpractice suit brought by the family of an 80-year-old grandmother they claim was prematurely declared dead by doctors, then frozen alive inside a body bag in the hospital's morgue. Yikes. The evidence for an ocean of water under the surface of Saturn's moon Enceladus appears to be overwhelming. The little world has excited scientists ever since jets of icy material were seen popping into space from a stripped region at the South Pole. Now, measurements using NASA's Cassini probe as a flyover like the moon have allowed researchers to detect the water's gravitational signal, and they say that there is a huge ocean there. That's interesting news. Up in the skies, though, what's going on? UFO reports seem to be everywhere. And who watches them for us? Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what's new this week?
Well, good evening, George, and as always, thanks for having me on tonight. It appears that we have some good company this week and are discussing the UFO phenomenon. I happen not to have a functioning television, but I've heard rumor to the effect that both President Bill Clinton and Dr. Henry Kissinger, both of them, have not just discussed the subject of UFOs on television this week, but they've actually initiated the subject, which is unusual. It seems to me, given that both those two gentlemen probably weigh and give great consideration to virtually every word they utter in a public forum, I suspect their comments have a significance that may go vastly beyond anything that any of us mere American citizens is aware of. My suspicion is that Bill Clinton actually may know much more than he's let on in the public forum. My longstanding suspicion is the injury he sustained on the evening of March 13th, 1997, at the home of Greg Norman, the Australian golfer, may have been related to the Phoenix Lights, a subject I've lectured on a number of occasions, and that I will probably lecture on again at McMinnville, Oregon, at the UFO Festival this year. Maybe you'll get a chance to hear that while you're there.
Sure.
But a lot's going on. I've talked about a lot of red lights. I've posted, I estimate, George, between 10,000 and 20,000 reports over the last 23 months of clusters of red, orange, yellow, amber, and gold lights. I invite people to go to our website. I see our trusty webmaster just updated it probably not more than 10 minutes ago, so we have a lot of fresh information there. But we're also now getting, curiously, reports of individual blue lights seen streaking across the night sky. Just this morning, I received a report from a young man in Scottsdale, Arizona, who asserted that last night, I think it was about 8 o'clock or thereabouts, we haven't received a written report from him yet, he and a group of his friends saw a blue light descend over South Mountain to the south of his home in Scottsdale, descend, stop, pause, reascend, go back up into the sky, drop again, jump to the left, jump to the right, and then just disappear from his sight. Very, very interesting sighting. I hope we get a written report from that gentleman. But we got a very similar report from Frederick, Maryland tonight. A couple were walking to their car in the parking lot at about 10:15 tonight. This is just 3 hours ago. and their attention was drawn to a very bright sapphire blue light in the night sky. They saw it for about 2 seconds. It faded. It came back. It faded again. It did that about 5 or 6 times, and they realized that it moved about 5 or 10 degrees across the sky during that time that they were looking at it. Very interesting report from Jefferson, Maine, this afternoon at 2:15 p.m. A gentleman, I seems to be an excellent witness, saw a cluster of about 16 objects, he counted, in the daytime sky over Jefferson, Maine, near Augusta. He said he was flabbergasted by it. He's written a very nice written report. People can see it on our website for today, the 4th of August. 4th of April, make that. And
it'll be August soon enough, Peter.
It's a very, very good report. Things are happening, George, and if it were not for Coast to Coast, I don't know how we'd be getting this information out to the American people. But my suspicion is very, very important things are taking place on our planet, and I'm very pleased to be able to bring this information to our listeners tonight.
Super. And as I always ask our listeners, of course, Peter does all of this out of his own pocket. The National UFO Reporting Center, he finances. So if you can go to his website, ufocenter.com, they do accept some donations. We're not talking about a lot of money. If everyone sent a dollar or two, Peter could keep the National UFO Reporting Center going for a long, long time. So you can find that at ufocenter.com. And once again, Peter, thank you for all you do. Up next, we're going to be talking about Maine ghosts and legends. That's right, in the state of Maine. Tom Verde joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. This hour, Tom Verde will be with us. His book, Maine Ghosts and Legends. Now, Tom is an award-winning journalist and author. He specializes in Middle Eastern and Mediterranean studies, early Christian history as well. He's traveled abroad quite extensively. And Tom, I've got to ask you, how did you get involved in writing about Maine ghosts with this kind of background that you have?
Well, thank you, first of all, George, for having me on the show.
My pleasure.
To be here. I got involved in writing about Maine ghosts when I lived in Maine a number of years ago, back in the late 80s.
Okay. So, and as you know, covering the Middle East that you have done so extensively, they're believers in what they call the jinn, which are genies or ghosts or something. So there's probably a lot of tie in there, don't you think?
Oh, yes. Actually, you know, there's a longstanding tradition in that part of the world, and really all over the world, of spiritualism, of, hauntings. There are even ghosts in the Bible, actually. If you go back and look at 1 Samuel, for instance, King Saul uses a medium called the Witch of Endor to help predict the outcome of a battle that he's about to engage in. And you mentioned the jinn. Yeah, the jinn are kind of devilish figures inhabiting the desert. The people there still do believe in jinn. They do come up. And actually, jinn is the root word of our of the word genie. Genies today in popular culture are thought of as, helpful figures. You get your wishes from them. But their origins were really from the demonic world, and they're really quite malevolent.
Tom, Maine, of course, a very quaint state. I love it. We broadcast there quite extensively. What things did you encounter there in your work and research? Ghostly and everything else.
Well, Maine, as an old bookseller that I talked to one time in Portland. I was living in Portland from 1985 to 1990, which is when I researched and wrote this book. This old bookseller once characterized Maine to me as the nation's attic, by which he meant people just kind of head up there and leave things there or store things there, or is it, it's just a place where a lot of things end up. And really, what better place to find ghosts than in an attic, if you think about it. But Maine is a place, of course, that's been inhabited by Westerners, you know, by Europeans, going back to the 17th century, and of course by Native Americans for millennia before that. But there's just an awful lot of dark corners in Maine. There's, you know, it's a huge state, and there's what they call the two Maines. You know, there's the coastal Maine, and then there's inland Maine. And I had the privilege and the pleasure of going around to different parts of the state and talking to various people who said they had some rather unusual experiences.
Give us some of your favorite stories, Tom, that you uncovered out there.
Well, there was one that I really I think is representative of a lot of the stories that are in my book, and that is they're not blood curdling stories, and they're not violent stories. They're stories that just kind of make you think, take a second look, or reconsider what that noise was that you might have heard. For instance, there was a woman in a town called Booth Bay Harbor who had a dog who ran away in the middle of the night, and she went to find her dog and actually discovered that the poor animal had been hit by a car. It was in the middle of a bridge, and she scooped him up and put him in the car and was driving at night to try and find the vet. She had actually just moved into town, so she didn't know the area that well. And she was driving in her car, trying to find the vet's office, and couldn't find it, was driving and driving in the middle of the night down this dark, winding road, looking for a house that she could ask directions from, somebody she could find to ask directions on how to get to the vet. There was only one house on that had lights on, so she ran up to the door and knocked on the door. And remember, this is probably 1 a.m. now. And the door opened, and there was a woman there and a man, very elderly, fully dressed, as she recalled, fully dressed as if they were going to go to church. And she asked the woman if she could help her, if she could direct her to the vet. And the woman very calmly asked her if she'd like to come inside. And she said, no, please, I have to get to the vet. So the woman said, okay, well, you drive down here, and this is how you get there. And so the woman with the dog went to the vet, and unfortunately, the poor dog didn't make it. Its back was broken, and it had to be put down. But so the woman, a couple of days later, wanted to go find the people to thank them for their assistance. Yeah. And she drove up and down the road, and she couldn't find the house again. And she tried looking for weeks and then months, and then as the years went by, when she lived there in Booth Bay Harbor, she would periodically say, I wonder where that house is. And she happened to be at a party and was talking to some friends and telling them this story. And another person overheard the story, some person who had grown up in Booth Bay Harbor. And she said, you know, I know that house, and I know those people, but they've been dead, and they've been dead for years, long before the woman ever knocked on the door. So this woman believed that these people were, she characterized them as guardian angels, people who showed up at the right time to help her out and then went back to wherever it was they were. And just to loop this back to the Bible again, this is what angels are sometimes considered to be. Angels and ghosts in the Bible can be interpreted as the same thing, really, depending on your point of view, of course.
Well, that's true. And I would guess, Tom, probably every state has had its series of ghostly encounters and legend stories, don't you think?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, in my book, I'm happy to have written this book about Maine ghosts. There are tons of books about New England ghosts. And then, yes, everywhere across our nation, you're going to find stories about people who have these kinds of encounters. And I'm willing to bet that many of the same elements will be present in those stories as I found in my stories. And those were, number one, people felt just a presence. They couldn't quite explain it, but they felt that there was a presence in the house or sometimes in the place of business. I have one story that actually the haunting takes place in a hair salon, believe it or not. So that's one thing. They just felt a presence. Another thing is changes in temperature. People would always talk about how they felt a sort of cold spot in the house that would indicate to them that there was some kind of presence there. Also, the sensitivity of animals and children to the presence of spirits. This is another
commonality. Hold on for a second, Tom. We'll talk more about this as we talk about Maine ghosts and legends. Well, next hour, Michael Luckman joins us. We're going to talk about his work, Alien Rock, the Rock and Roll Extraterrestrial Connection. It's an amazing story, so he'll be with us, so stand by for that. Welcome back to Coast, Tom Verde with us. He's the author of a number of books, including Maine Ghosts and Legends. Tom, by the way, if folks want to pick up this book and have some fun with it, where do they get it?
I'm glad you mentioned that, George. You can order the book online at Down East Books or downeast.com, actually. And I'm sure any of your local bookstores could get it in for you. And one other thing that I would like to mention, in case some of your sharp-eared listeners, and I'm sure there are many of those, may have picked up on when I said I wrote this back in the late 80s when I was living in Maine. I wrote the first edition back then. The book that you can get now is the second edition, which has some additional stories put in it and was revised a little bit. I revised some of the chapters. So I just wanted to clarify that for you and your listeners.
Sure thing. Now, when you also talk about legends that are out there and other encounters, what other things have been happening out there in the Maine?
Well, Maine, having such a dramatic coast, has an awful lot of nautical maritime legends connected with it. There's a ghost ship called the Dash, which is from the 18th century, that is supposed to reappear periodically whenever the descendant of a crew member dies. The ship comes along to collect their soul. There's also individual stories of little families who experienced some hauntings at their seaside cottages, neighborly folks, people who had died and then came back to just check on them to see if their boats were okay and things like that. So really, you know, friendly ghosts, if you will. But there's also a lot of legends connected with the islands. You know, the islands of Maine, and there are so many of them, have a lot of romantic legends attached to them, the legends of pirates and buried treasure and whatnot. And so you'll find an awful lot of those kinds of legends where, you know, pirates or the ghosts of pirates are supposed to appear, or people search for buried treasure and find other things that they weren't expecting. You know, Maine is, again, a very colorful place for these kinds of stories, and it's so atmospheric, really, with its rugged coast and its mists and its fog and whatnot.
Were you a little skeptical at first, you know, when you were doing the research for this?
Well, yes. You know, I mean, I went into this, to be honest with you, as a journalist. I mean, I wrote these, I researched these stories initially as a series of radio stories for Maine Public Broadcasting. And it was around Halloween time back in 1988, and I thought it would be a good idea to broadcast some stories, you know, in the state of Maine, you know, Maine ghost stories. And what I found was I went at it by talking to people and just taking their stories. I didn't look at it as a trying to disprove anything or prove anything. I really just wanted to be an objective storyteller here. And that's how I've treated the people that I spoke with. I treated them with respect. I gave them the benefit of the doubt. My approach was, if they could convince me that what they saw, what they experienced, was true to them, then I took their word for it. If I sensed that they were trying to con me or they were perhaps not so reliable, you know, then I just wouldn't include their story in my book.
Well, that's a good point. Let's take a few calls here for you. Let's go to Sean, east of the Rockies, truck driving in Maine. Hey, Sean, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yeah, just an added story I could add on to Tom's experiences here. I used to work on an island called Great Diamond Island. It used to be right off the coast of Portland. And I was the head of security there. It was an old fort. An architect had bought it off the U.S. government. He had redone in the whole place, and different people had bought different homes, and he redid the fort. So I'd have to go around at night and check, you know, all the buildings, make sure everything was locked up and whatnot. And I would go around this one building that used to be the old barracks, and I would look up, and there would always be a light on the third floor, and I would see this dark figure come to the window, and I'd, you know, do a double take and go, what is it? Somebody up there? So I'd go around, because it was like an old parade ground. And when I got around to the other side, that dark figure would be all the way downstairs on the first floor, looking at me through that window. So I'd drive around again, and then the lights would go off. It would happen every night. So one night I was like, "I, this is going to sound crazy," but I went in and I said, "Hey, look, I think this thing is haunted. Is this thing haunted?" And everybody in the staff stopped, looked at me like it was a secret they weren't supposed to tell. And so they said, they eventually took me in another room. They said, "Yes, it's haunted." We had a maid that was cleaning that room one time, and she went up the stairs, and she said this thing went through her. And so I said, "What?" She said, "Yeah, this thing went through her," and she cried. She said, "I want to quit right now. I want to be taken to the ferry and taken off the island." And so every night I would see that thing as I went by, and let's just say there was the shortest employment I ever had. I would never go near that place. And I was sitting there one time. I had to drop off a few guests there, and it was funny because I'm looking, and I see that it was the sixth building, number F, and the sixth door. And when you add that up, it's 666. It sounds crazy, but that I was like, I'm never going in there. I don't care what happens in there, even though I'm the head of security. I'm just going to let it happen. I'm not going near it.
That's a great story. That is a great story.
So that's what happened all the time. When I'd go in the main building, I went in there one night to do my laundry, and the doors would open. I couldn't open the door back up. I'm yelling, "Hey, who's on the other side of this?" That kind of stuff. And I said, forget it. I was only there for a couple of months. I quit. I said, I'm done with this. I had just gotten the job after I got out of the Marine Corps, and I was in charge of the whole place, had my own crew, that kind of stuff. I said, I'm not sticking around on this place anymore.
You know, that's great. I mean, that's a really interesting story. And I'll tell you, there's another island, and not too far away, called Jewel Island, that is in my book. That tells of a very similar kind of haunting of figures from World War II. You know, during World War II, the whole coast, both coasts, were fortified, you know, against, on the East Coast against Nazi invasion, on the West Coast against Japanese invasion. And so there are all kinds of abandoned tunnels and facilities and whatnot on these islands. And in Jewel Island, as I say, a young girl recalled for me how she saw people, men in olive drab uniforms with, you know, helmets walking around on the island. A very similar kind of experience to what your caller has mentioned. And another interesting thing, you know, about islands and ghosts, and that is, according to some legends, ghosts are supposed to be unable to cross water, so they become trapped in a place. So an island, of course, they would never be able to get off.
Tom, as you look at the supernatural stories specifically from Maine, have you come to any specific conclusions about what you think this all is?
Yeah, you know, I have, and what I think is, I think that there are people who have a sensitivity to spirits, and there are people who don't. The same way there are people who can play tennis, and there are people who can't, and I myself, you know, people ask me, have I ever seen a ghost? And I have to tell you, I don't believe I ever have. I don't believe I've ever had an experience like the experiences that I've written about in my book. But the commonality of the experiences, of the details of the experiences, I think are just too, you know, too
weird.
Rooted. Yeah, I mean, it's just too much. You know, you can't say that these people are making these things up. You know, there'd be some collective consciousness here of making up details, because the details seem to line up so much with all these people's story. People who don't know each other, in different places, different settings, different times, and so I think really that there are people who are just more sensitive to the spirit world, if you will, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, God bless them, or God help them, however you want to look at it.
Let's go to Andrew in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Welcome to the program. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Tom. How are you guys doing tonight?
Good. Great. Thank
Hello.
You.
I just had a question for Tom. I have this photograph that I took on my parents' beach in Door County, Wisconsin, a few years back. And, you know, I've seen orb photographs and I've seen all sorts of things, but I can't seem to identify whatever this thing is. It almost looks like an energy cluster. I've sent it in to Linda at Earth Files, and she's gotten back to me with a couple of inquiries, and I'm still waiting to hear back from her about that.
Okay, good.
But we've seen some orb photos. You know, I've researched orb photos trying to find something similar to what I've captured, and it almost seems like a cluster of white energy surrounded by an orange hue, and it actually has like a tail. And the reason I got this picture is because I was taking a photo of my dog on the beach, and this thing appeared in it, in this image. And I tried to snap a couple of photos right after that, and it didn't appear. So, you know, I just picked up Photoshop about 6 months ago, and I put it in there. And when I zoomed in and really looked at it and adjusted some of the settings, you can see that it's not like, and I don't know, Tom, how much have you ever done anything with kind of like trying to identify anomalies in a photograph? Is there anybody that can help me identify this? Or?
Well, I don't have a lot of experience in that particular area, but I will say, of course, that it is a recognized phenomenon that, people see various things in photographs that were not there when they took the photograph. Now, whether or not that could be the kinds of vagaries of the, processing, or of course, what you took, was it a digital photograph that you're talking about?
And
you still there, Andrew?
Yeah, we've lost him there.
We've lost him. They've taken him away. But I'm pretty sure it probably was digital, Tom, and most of them are now.
Yeah, he was talking about a modern photograph. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, again, as I say, this is there are whole books written about this, and looking at these kinds of images is fascinating. It certainly is fascinating, and there are some images that really, you know, cannot be explained.
I mean, there's no question that strange things have been happening. When they talk now about multiverses, and we're still trying to figure out how in the heck we got here as human beings and where we're headed and everything else, it's probably very natural that the other side, the ghostly existence, whatever you want to call it, is probably very normal.
Oh, yeah, certainly. If you just look upon it as another part of our existence as humans, then, you know, you need not be troubled, I think. You know, as I say, most of the stories in my book are about very nice ghosts. They're not really malevolent. There's a couple that cause some trouble, but for the most part, they're just beings that are there. Perhaps who don't know they're dead, or that's another common element. Spirits tend to linger in a place where something happened in their lives that was either traumatic, sad, perhaps happy, and they just don't want to leave. But also to your point, you know, in the first edition of my book, I had an epigraph in the beginning, which is a favorite quote of mine from Hamlet, which, if you think about it, is a terrific ghost story, really. And that is Hamlet to Horatio. He says, you know, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. And so that, by that he meant, you know, you can't know everything just by book learning. There are things in this world that you need to just experience and try and accept.
Let's go east now. Sean's in Sanford, Maine. Hey, Sean, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yep, we sure can.
Yeah, I'm on speakerphone, so I wasn't sure if there was an echo or something.
Okay, no, you're okay.
Yeah, I lived most of the first 6 years of my life in Ogunquit, Maine. Tom, are you familiar with Ogunquit?
Oh, yeah, that's way up there.
Yeah, have you ever heard of the Ogunquit Playhouse?
Yes, I believe I have, yeah.
Yeah, that's a supposed haunted location. I don't know whether you know anything about that or...
Well, I don't have specifics for you. I know that Ogunquit has some very interesting ghostly traditions, particularly somebody told me when I was up there last, not in Ogunquit, but up in Maine, about a particular haunting that takes place on the turnpike, actually, up on the highway.
I used to live within a couple, maybe a quarter mile of that turnpike.
Yeah. I mean, the truckers talk about this a lot, actually. See the figure on the road.
We used to wave goodbye to the tourists, you know, at the end of the summer season, you know, as they go home, you know, on that highway.
Right. But in terms of the playhouse, you know, I've heard of it. I don't know too much about the ghostly stories that are associated with it, though.
And so do you stop at just this main ghostly book, or are there others coming?
Well, I don't know at this point. I would like to work on another book. I mean, perhaps about I live now in Connecticut. And I would love to explore stories in here in Connecticut. Also, a woman that I talked to the other day about this topic of ghosts and a ghost book lived in Hawaii, and she said, you know, you really ought to explore Hawaii. I thought, wow, I never even considered ghosts in Hawaii. But,
as we said
earlier in the show, they're everywhere. So, I don't know. I don't know if I can get a publisher to send me to Hawaii, but if you can find one, please let me know, all right?
Well, we've got a studio out there, Tom. We're going to start using it in June. It's done, ready to go, and it's on the Big Island.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations.
So we'll check out any ghost stories there, and I'll feed them to you.
Okay, great.
You know,
great,
you just never know. So, you know, with all of this, I've got to get you back to talk about some of your work in the Middle East as well. I bet you've got a million stories that you can talk to us about current events that are happening there, and I'd love to get your perspective on that, if that's okay.
Sure, that would be fine.
And give out your website, Tom.
Oh, well, you can find me at tomverdi.pressfolios.com. Tom Verdi, all one word, and then Pressfolios, P-R-E-S-S. FOLIOS.com.
All right, Tom, thank you so much.
You can get the book at downeast.com.
Super. And up next, we're going to talk more about the strange and unusual on Coast to Coast AM.